this regular meeting of Amesburg Town Council to order. Item number two, special in-camera council meeting. Need a motion? Council Pujia.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. The council move into an in-camera meeting of council at 5:00 PM pursuant to section 239 of the Municipal Act 2001, as amended for the following reason. Item A, update on current bylaw enforcement matter, section 239(2)(f). Advice is subject to solicitor client privilege, including communications necessary for that purpose.
Thank you. Second, Council Levine. All those in favor? Carried. Can I get a motion to resume the regular meeting? Councilor Fryer, Councilor Melange, all those in favor? Carried. And please stand for a moment of silent reflection. Is there any disclosure of pecuniary interest? Councilor Melange?
I'd like to declare conflict on item 9.2. The one Melange mentioned in the decision summary is my plug.
Thank you. Any other disclosures of pecuniary interest? Okay, seeing none, that brings us to item 8, the minutes of the previous meeting. Councilor Pryor?
I move the minutes be received.
Second, Councilor Pujia. Is there any corrections for those minutes? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor? Carried. And that brings us to 9.1, the request for the signed bylaw exemption, John Collison.
Good evening, everyone. I live at 71 Sandwich. My name is John Collison, and I am requesting that the signed business sign be located on the encroachment of the town property. The sign is a round sign. It's 7 feet wide by 5 feet high. And if I was to follow the requested bylaws, which is 6 feet back from the property line, it wouldn't be able to be seen. So I'm looking to see if I can have the property, the sign, be on the property line and then 7 feet onto the township property. So that's my request.
Councilor Melange?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Can we bring up page 41, which shows a picture of the property? My question is to Mr. Coulson, why could the sign not be from the property line towards your property and said, it looks like there's sufficient grass there to put your sign on?
It's a little bit deceiving with the picture.
I'm sorry?
It's a little bit deceiving by the picture. If I was to go with the, on the property line itself and go back, I would be into the garden area.
Also, the spacing that you're showing is not exact.
Yeah, it's not exact. In the measurements, the measurements that's there, if you were to look at the measurements, the property line itself, and then if I was to go out 7 feet, then I would be left from the edge of the sidewalk to the sign itself 6 feet. So if I was to go on the property line and go back, then the sign itself is too far back, and when you're driving down the road, you can't really see the sign itself.
Okay.
Thank you.
Is there any other questions? Councilor Fryer?
I guess through you, Mr. Mayor, to John, the only concern I have is for vehicles turning from St. Arthur onto Samuel Street. So to get a better depiction of that, I think it would be easier for me, but right now I think you're going to cause a blind spot for drivers and for kids coming down on bicycles. I know a lot of people use this and hook into the new Texas Road to the Greenway, so I'd have a concern with that, because this isn't exact, so unless there's something that comes to me exactly how it's gonna be laid out in all the views, I think then the residents can understand the decision that councilor could make on this.
Okay, so if you were to take a look at the picture of the Ricardo sign, that Ricardo sign is closer to the sidewalk itself at St. Arnold, so my sign wouldn't be protruding so much as Ricardo's sign itself. The Ricardo sign is right on the corner of St. Arnold.
Yep.
And so my sign would only be 5 feet off the finished grade, where the Ricardo sign is really at the St. Arnold's street.
Okay.
Yeah. So my sign is much less intrusive.
And that would have been my question as well. Nicole, did we check sight lines for the sign?
Through you, Carlo, I didn't go out to the site to review. During the encroachment agreement phase, if council were to approve the exemptions to the bylaw, we would put an email out to all the interested parties and ensure sight lines are okay, check with utilities, and go through all our checks and balances before we'd authorize that type of encroachment.
The property has been recently surveyed also, and the survey stakes are in as of just a few months ago. So the survey stakes are exact.
And if I'm looking at that picture, are you saying that the sign would sit further back than those bushes?
Yes, that's correct.
So you'd actually see the bushes before you saw that sign?
Yes. And that's part of the problem. On the other side of my property, there's a tree. If you look at the other picture, there's a tree, and that tree sticks out further. The Ricardo sign sticks out further with the bush. So my sign is a little bit more recessed and less intrusive, and it's only 5 feet tall.
Okay, Councilor Levine?
Through you. So I see you already have this sign up on the pedestal. Are you taking that one down?
Yeah, part of the problem is there's a little bit of confusion when people are looking for Ricardo's restaurant. They see the Woodland sign, and also when they see the Woodland sign, they're going to Ricardo's and they're looking to see if my business is there.
Right.
So people are going into Ricardo's looking for my business. And my business is the residence.
Okay, Councilor Pugin.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I just want to remind Council that as a member of the Parks Committee, our Parks Committee and Communities in Bloom Committee have been very concerned about any, and in fact, I believe a motion is coming before us, any changes to our sign bylaws. You know, our sign bylaws are in place, and they want to ensure that we're following the rules that we set forth regarding these sign bylaws. So that's the only thing I want council to be aware of.
Okay, Councilor Malash.
This is a follow-up to a comment made that you were going to remove the one sign. Is it permanently that all we're going to see is one sign on that pole?
Yeah, I would think that Ricardo's might do a little bit of hours, advertising, or specials, maybe to that effect.
I guess I was, you know, trying to kill two birds with one stone. If there's a concern about the proliferation of signs and you were pulling that one down and substituting it with one in a somewhat different location, again, we reduce the size of the sign, reduce some of that what people call, you know, sign pollution. That's just a question that came to mind, is whether or not you would permanently take that part of it out.
Yes, so with the removal of the Woodland part,
mm-hmm.
If council, Mr. Mayor, we would prefer not to have any other advertising, then be left blank. So that would be something that you would consider. But it is there for advertisement. However, Ricardo's would like to use that space.
Yeah, I think the question, unless I'm mistaken, is would you remove Ricardo's sign? And the answer is no, because Ricardo's needs to advertise and you would like to advertise on a separate.
Correct. Just clarification, I'm not talking about removing the Ricardo sign. I'm
okay.
Talking about removing the Woodland
sign. Just the Woodland
sign. Yes. Yes, so the Woodland sign would be removed. But something would have to be there in its place because it has the bulbs, the lights, and all that stuff, yeah.
Question for Nicole. So without the requested variance, the sign would meet all of our sign bylaw rules anyway and could still go up?
Through you, Mayor Carlo. So the request for this sign requires two exemptions to the bylaw. One, to exceed the 30 square feet. The next being for the allowance of it to encroach essentially on town property and not meet the 6 feet, 6 inches setback from that lot line. And then we'd enter into the encroachment agreement if those exemptions are signed by law were approved by council.
Okay, so let's do it. Councilor Pryor?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I make a motion that council approve the exemption to the sign bylaw and enter an encroachment agreement with the woodland company.
Thank you. Second, Councilor Melange. And we would just like the exact wording of the exemptions.
Through you, Mr. Mayor, if I can ask for council's indulgence to move the motion that exemption to section 931 to allow for a sign 35 square feet. An exemption to section 932 to allow for a ground sign to encroach on town property and not to be at least 2 meters away from the lot line, and to authorize administration to enter into an encroachment agreement.
So that would include the two items. That's all right, yes. Councilor Pugin?
I'm requesting a recorded vote. Please.
Okay. Councilor Walsh? Councilor Pryor?
On the question itself, with entering into an encroachment agreement being town property, the municipality will have, if they have to do work there, it would be the owner of the sign that would have to, or the town would have to, after it's erected, remove the sign and put it back up. What would the agreement be between the two? Because if we have to do work in that area for a sewer or water lines, what's the agreement? What would be the liability of the residents?
Through Mayor Carlo, typically in the encroachment agreement, we put all those charges at work. Cost of the work, the town would still do the project, but the cost of that would be the owner of the sign, to the owner of the sign.
Jeff Servine, did you have your hand up?
I guess I'm just wondering on administration's opinion on encroaching on the property line there, if it would create an issue with other businesses wanting to do the same thing along that right away.
Through your worship, any business is allowed to come here before council to ask for an exemption, as is Mr. Colson. So that's solely a council decision. Council could review each one independently and make a decision supporting or denying them.
Okay, any further questions? Councilor Courtney?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. With all due respect to Mr. Colson, is it?
Collison.
Yep. I just worry again that we are setting ourselves up to other requests. If we grant this request, I'm sure that others are going to follow. And as we've seen with the waiving of the fees for different functions in the town, we've got a bylaw in place, and we've waived many, many, many fees and have lost quite a bit of money. And if we have a bylaw, as we were told a few months ago in a workshop that we had, I think we need to be cognizant of those bylaws and kind of stick to them as best we can. I'm not against Mr. Collison's request. I just worry about it opening the door to similar requests. And if we say yes to him, then we'll be more or less having to say yes to the others as well.
So if I may, I've considered all that, and I can appreciate and understand that. In the location itself, I'm in a business location. On the east side of that street, you have Ricardo's, and you have Joe Melange Board, and so on and so on. There's no residential there, so I'm kind of just blending in with all the commercial part of it. on the east side. On the west side is all residential. And with the Ricardo sign and the Joe Melange sign and all the commercial, I'm not really standing out any more than anybody else because of that location. If I was in a more of a residential area, then I could appreciate and understand that. But because of where I'm located, it's not interfering or taking away from any other thing other than the commercial aspect of it all. And that's why I was requesting this.
Question, Council Milan?
Comment.
I think you're... Question, Council Pugia?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Mayor. Through you to Nicole. Nicole, prior to this request, that place was used as a residence and it wasn't used as a building, that home, correct?
Are we speaking to the applicant?
Yes.
It's, to my knowledge, has always been the place of business.
The house. That house was never used as a business, I understood. It was a residence. The actual house that he's referring to, right at the where he wants to put the sign, it was used as a residence, correct? Until this, the present owner?
Yes, it's zoned commercial, but it was always used as residential.
Correct.
But it is zoned along with all the other businesses as a commercial.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, seeing none.
Okay, a recorded vote has been requested, and the motion on the floor for Council's consideration once again is that delegation be received. An exemption to section 931 to allow for a sign of 35 square feet be approved. An exemption to section 932 to allow for a ground sign to encroach on town property and not to be at least 2 meters away from the lot line be approved. And administration be authorized to enter into an encroachment agreement. Councilor Courtney.
Support.
Deputy Mayor Pantikos-Gwali?
Support.
Councilor Fryer?
Support.
Councilor Levine?
Support.
Councilor Melosh?
Support.
Councilor Pugier?
Opposed.
Mayor DiCarlo?
Support.
Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Coulson.
Thank you very much.
That brings us to 9.2, the request to waive invoice fee for open burn, William Monroe Sipcar.
We were told the only way to do this when we initially got the invoice was to appeal to the fire marshal. We did. The order was rescinded, so we just assumed that the bill was going to be taken off because they put it on our tax bill. And when it wasn't, we were told that we need to appear before the council, and that's why I'm here for today.
Okay. Chief or Deputy Chief?
Thank you, Your Worship. I can perhaps shed a little bit of light on this situation because there's actually two situations at play. On July 23rd, 2016, which was a Saturday evening, we were advised of a burn taking place in the 6,000 block of Southside Road. Our duty officer attended and found a pile of brush, etc., approximately 15 feet by 20 feet by 4 feet high, being burned, and was not attended by anyone of competence to supervise the fire. Staff were called to extinguish the fire, which brings into play our bylaw regarding open burning. Open burning in the rural areas of the community is permitted under certain conditions. And a primary condition is that we be notified a minimum of 2 hours in advance, which we were not. And the fire was not attended by anyone illustrating competence to supervise. extinguished, and we identified Mr. William Sipkar, who actually resided at 6641 Southside Road, who was the owner of the property and responsible. So two things occurred. Our municipal bylaw, which council passed, requiring fees for those occurrences where our services are called out to extinguish the fire. So an invoice was generated for that service in accordance with the bylaw. And on the Monday, the 25th of July, 2016, our assistant deputy chief attended for the purposes of dealing with any violations to the Ontario Fire Code. And an inspection order was issued, and that is the piece that was appealed to the fire marshal as due process allows, and the information is provided actually on the back of the inspection order advising the individuals that they have the ability to appeal the order. And so there may be some misunderstanding with Mr. Sipkar and company relative to two different processes. It was found by the fire marshal in the appeal that there was some errors made on the inspection order, and as a result, and rightly so, that inspection order, their appeal was upheld, and the inspection order relative to the offense of violating the fire code was found to be null and void. However, it still remained that the bylaw had been violated with no call specifically being made to the department. And as a result, the invoice was generated and remains outstanding. And I believe that that is what they are here today to ask for council's indulgence.
Thank you. Questions? Councilor Pluja?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Through you to Chief Montone. Chief Montone, it's just very disturbing that your fire department did a lot of work. They attended the site. They did everything right. But yet, somebody from the fire marshal's delegate was able to rescind this report and to say it wasn't an open burn. So would you please elaborate on how that person was able to do it? She didn't attend the site, correct?
So when the review of the order was undertaken by the Office of the Fire Marshal, they noted that the order had been written requiring basically the Sipkars to be in compliance with the fire code retroactively, which is impossible. And so as a result, based on that technicality, they had no choice because the officer attended on the 25th, the offense had occurred on the 23rd, and so it's impossible for them to comply. And so as a result, they deemed the inspection order null and void. And they did make specific reference to the burn bylaw issue and very rightly identified that to be a civil matter and beyond their scope.
Can I make a comment?
Sure.
I'm just listening with all the respect, I'm not sure,
sure.
Your name.
Yep.
But just want to say that the night in question, when they sent the first fire engine that came and the gentleman, we already retired for the night, I heard a knock on the door and the man came and I was shocked. He said, I'm here because somebody reported there's a fire. And I'm like, well, there's no fire here. I'm thinking, fire? What's he talking about? And then I think, oh, maybe he's talking the fire that we had going earlier that day because we were burning farm trimmings and brush that we have done on the farm on property for 40 some years prior. We are negligent, or I guess being ignorant, not knowing that we had to call in. Did not know that's a bylaw. So yes, we are guilty of not calling it in. And since we realized that's what you have to do, we have been doing, we have had a few fires since then, called it in every time, got a permit. So yes, we are negligent of that, I admit. But the fact we were shocked that the man that stood at my front door late at night, and they're calling it, again, no disrespect to the fire people, a burn in an open fire, when you're sitting on an engine that's 12 feet high, and you got a man, and he comes to the door and asks me, where's the fire? There was no fire. We tended, we're not negligent. We've been doing this for a long time, and we never would leave an open fire burning. We retired for the night, the fire, it was smoldering, like maybe, you know, when you have smoke when the fire's done smoldering stuff. And so my husband got out of his, out of bed and walked them in to show them where the fire is. I'm sorry, so what we did when we appealed, we stated exactly what happened. So, and this is just a matter of principle, like, so we were told by somebody that they called wrong, the man that was there should not have called an open burn. They could have called in a smoldering or just a after the fact something, but not an open burn. There was no fire when they came. And it was actually, everybody was kind of amused that they would send four, or I don't know how many engines, 20 some people in a, to a private residence where my husband knew all the people coming to tend to a brush of smoldering. It was kind of embarrassing. We thought, wow, what a waste of taxpayers' money. I'm sorry.
Chief, can I just get clarification on the, did the fire department report twice, once to put out the fire and then once again later, or?
Well, we attended the scene twice, once for the evening of the fire on the 23rd. Actually, we had 12 staff attend in terms of when the firefighters were paged out, 12 firefighters responded. And the, plus the duty officers from Station 2. The firefighters were coming from Station 3. The duty officer made his observations, recorded them in his report. Whether it matters or not, his day job, he's a local police officer, so I think his observations were recorded accurately. I can only go by the report I see, and this did occur almost a year ago. But he made his observations, he described the fire. The district chief who attended his report reported the same things in terms of the size of the fire, and the fire may have in fact been only smoldering when the civic cars left the area, but indeed when they arrived that wasn't the case, and that is in fact one of the hazards of open burning, is that if it's not supervised and if it's not extinguished properly, then these kinds of things can occur. But we weren't aware of the original burn either. And so if I can just very quickly identify the provision in the bylaw, which talks to no person shall set an open air fire referred to in section 3, which is the farming areas of the community as described in the bylaw. No person shall set an open fire without notifying a member of the Amherstburg Fire Department at least 2 hours prior to the time of setting such a fire. And so based on those very narrow requirements of the bylaw, an invoice has been issued.
Councilor Boucher, question?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Ms. Sivkar, I really appreciate you coming before us and the fact that, you know, you were worried and embarrassed about this. But saying that, and I do appreciate that you didn't know at the time, and then afterwards, once you were aware of our bylaw, you did follow all the necessary steps to have your open burns. But our fire department can't guess. I think they did due diligence as soon as they received a call. We would be criticized greatly if they hadn't sent out 12 men or men or women or whatever. And say it was really close to a house and it caught fire and you're, you know, you lived closer and you had children there. That's what our fire department does. They act on complaints and they send out trucks and they do it to save lives. And I don't think we can fault them for that. I think we should be praising them for that.
But through you, Mr. Mayor, I would like to direct my question to our town lawyer.
Okay.
So through you to Mr. Galvin. So it just isn't
clear to me 100%. Would we have the right to collect this fee based on, you know, we have two different reports, one from our fire department and one from the delegate from the Ontario Fire Marshal's office. So where does that leave us regarding the invoice?
I think the fire chief, rightly through you, Mayor, the fire chief rightly said there are two different provisions. This is really for the recouping of the administration costs based on the user fee bylaw. And that's something that council has endorsed on a number of occasions. Just as it is the right of the resident to come and appeal to council, and council decide on their due diligence whether or not the facts of the case warrants you to forgive that or not. I looked briefly at the bylaw and the documents, and it looks like to me it's validly late, the invoice, in terms of what was done. But they are two separate provisions, and as I understand it, the other charge was really looked at upon as not capable of being followed based on the dating of the charge. So it is a separate procedure, and this really allows council to recoup administrative costs for attendance. The bylaw does allow, and I, as I stand, and the chief can jump in, the two-hour notification is really to allow when calls do come in, they can look at, they know that should be occurring in that place and that there's somebody there. I think the second part of that is it's sort of intimated in the bylaw that somebody will be there attending that. So if there's a flood of calls that this is out of control, then they can attend. But without knowing on a specific piece of property, without that notification immediately, and I guess you correct me if I'm wrong, Chief and Deputy Chief, they would send out the troops. So is it working?
Yes, exactly.
Councilor Green?
Thank you. I have a little confusion about this because I guess through you to the Ms. Sipkar, the way you came across was this, when the fire department showed up, there was no fire.
Yep.
Because we have a report here from on-duty officers and captains saying that there was a fire and they had to extinguish it. It took 12 men, and you're saying that didn't occur.
There was no fire. Like I said, when the guy came to the front door, he asked me, because I opened the door, he asked me, where's the fire? And I said, fire? I don't know what he's talking about. And then it occurred to me that we were burning during the day, and then my husband went and showed him. Like I said, it was smoke, there was no fire. Like when you say open burn, I expect a fire.
Well, yeah, I mean, so the report says a 20-foot by 15-foot fire, 3 to 4 feet high.
It'd
be hard to confuse that with
no
a smoldering.
There was no 3 foot fire. There was, you know, when you, after you burn stuff, there's like smoke.
Okay.
That's what it was.
Okay. And I appreciate.
So if you're saying 3 foot fire, there was no fire. We wouldn't, like, we lived there for 30 years.
Yeah.
And my husband's parents before that, and they've been doing that for all these years on the farm. And I know that, I'm sorry, don't know your name, but you made a note that close to homes, it is way in the back of the property, away from any buildings and the homes. So we would never do something to endanger our home.
I don't have any concern with that. My concern is that you're suggesting that our deputy chief and 12 of our experienced firefighters are lying in their report.
I'm not saying that they're lying. They're simply, the way that it states there, that there was an open burn fire.
Oh yeah, it says
there,
my husband can come
because of the business arrangement prior meetings, but there was, you can ask all the children. I mean, I don't know what else to say. I'm telling you, there was no 3 foot fire burning, open burn. It was a smoldering leftovers of a fire. I'm sorry. I mean, if we're going to
you can appreciate our concern, though. We have the reporting here from our fire department, who we have to rely on for the safety of our community and our residents, and they're saying there's a fire, and you're saying there's no fire.
And I respect to where you're coming from, but that's the reason why we felt the need to appeal this, because we felt it was an overkill to a situation that did not require what was done. And we feel like maybe, I don't know what the reasoning was to call all the firemen to the, and that's why we appealed it. We were told this is the process. We've never been through anything like this before.
I know, I understand.
So we just did what we were told.
Okay, if I may.
Yes.
If there's a 3 to 4 foot, 20 by 15 foot fire, I would suggest anybody call the fire department, not why did they show up. Okay, that's my personal opinion. Through you to
I'm
Nicole.
Sorry.
In regards to our bylaw, I know that the user fee, we recently passed it within, say, the last year for this charge. But I guess maybe this is better served to one of the fire department. Was there an open burn bylaw before that required an open burn to be called in prior to a call to?
Thank you for the question, Councillor, through your worship. My understanding is a year ago these fees were established by council, and that prior to that they were not in place. And so I know in 2016 I took a look back, just anticipating some of the questions that might be asked. We issued 14 invoices last year.
So this isn't something new.
It isn't.
And my other concern is, as far as we had a fire bylaw before the user fee was in place. And did that prior fire bylaw require an open burn to be called in at all?
It's actually the same bylaw.
Okay, so there's my concern, is that you're suggesting we've been doing this for 40 years and not following the bylaw the entire time.
And again, we were ignorant, and I admitted to that. So if they want to fine us for being ignorant and whatever the fee is, fine for not calling it in, I would agree to that. But I'm sorry, we just felt like this isn't right to be penalized for because they sent so many engines when there was no open burn. That I'm sorry, that's like, if there's a fee for not calling in a farm burning, whatever, fine, we are guilty of that.
Yeah,
but
and that's my concern. We've had this issue with other. We had a fine mile issue with an organization
like
a few weeks ago that said, oh, we had no idea this was a law. Now we're being accused of breaking it. It's kind of akin to saying, well, I've been speeding here my whole life, and now you gave me a ticket, and I don't want to pay it.
And I'm saying, give me a ticket. We were ignorant. We didn't know. Okay, we're guilty of that. But I'm sorry. Open a burning fire.
Okay, thank you.
Councilor Courtney?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Through you to the chief. Okay, the issue seems to be here, was there a fire or was there not a fire? And when you and your men arrived at the scene, was there a fire 20 feet by 15 feet, like 3 to 4 feet in height, or was there just smoldering?
Thank you, Councillor, for the question. Based on the reports of the officers, there was a fire 15 feet by 20 feet by 3 to 4 feet high that they extinguished.
Councilor Frey.
I move receipt of the delegation.
And second, Councilor Bouge. Is there any further questions? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor? Carried. Received, and there will be no change.
Thank you.
Thank you. That brings us to, I believe we're doing 9.3 and 9.4 at the same time. Teresa McClenahan and Sean Patrick Stenzel.
Thank you very much, Mayor DiCarlo and Council. My name is Sean Patrick Stenzel. I am a senior energy analyst with Greenpeace Canada. We're going to run our presentations back to back. We hope that this will save time. I'm joined today by Teresa McClenahan, the Executive Director of the Canadian Environmental Law Association. We're here today in the spirit of cooperation. Our organizations have been advocating for strengthened nuclear emergency response since the Fukushima disaster began in 2011. We think we have faced some common challenges that your council has had, and we'd like to make an offer of help, but also recommendations on how we can strengthen emergency preparedness in Ontario. So to do this, I'm going to run through quickly what we've been doing, the opportunity for strengthening emergency response, as well as recommendations for improving public safety. So first of all, what we've been doing. So for the past 6 years, when the Fukushima disaster began, our organizations worked quite closely related to the Ontario reactors in terms of safety. And since the beginning, we've been saying we have 20 reactors in the Greater Toronto, or 10 reactors in the Greater Toronto Area, we need to look at off-site nuclear emergency response in light of Fukushima. And it's been an uphill battle, and I'll tell you the reason why, is unlike other areas of policy development, the provincial government doesn't have a required transparent process for reviewing and updating nuclear emergency response. I work on other files, such as energy planning. We're consulted every 3 years. and that consultation is with all stakeholders and it's done transparently. Same on, Teresa can talk about many, many other environmental issues, but on this file we don't do it. And what that means is that there's little public scrutiny of this file, and it means that decision makers in the provincial bureaucracy don't necessarily have a good motivation for strengthening emergency response in a timely manner. And I think that's the problem set that we have faced, and then your council has also faced. What we did about it is we in fact went to the federal government. There are regular relicensing hearings for reactors in Ontario, and our organizations, as well as hundreds of other citizens, raised these issues post-Fukushima with the Canadian regulator. And it became very clear to the federal regulator that the province was dragging its feet. And it also got us some attention from the provincial government. In 2013, we met with the Minister of Community Safety at the time and talked about our issues, and she committed to do a public consultation for the first time. It's not required in legislation, but she could see that we were being given the runaround. It's 4 years later, and that consultation has just begun. But it took us speaking out publicly to get traction. So I think there's a bit of a lesson in that. And we use the CNC hearings to do that. And that leads us now to an opportunity. Is that consultation has been launched. It was launched last month. So despite waiting 6 years, we've been given about 60 days to respond to a provincial discussion paper on nuclear emergency response. We have some concerns with the discussion paper. We won't get into too much detail. But the fact is there is an opportunity for municipalities and the public to advocate for strengthened emergency response, but also just a transparent process moving forward. And I think the message for your council is other municipalities are using this process. The City of Toronto's executive committee that's responsible for emergency response has asked their staff for a report on it because they would like to weigh in on this issue and give recommendations to the province. Same thing with Whitby Council and Durham Council. So this is an opportunity for you to speak directly and publicly to the province about your concerns. Our organizations have been advocating for strengthening emergency response. And this, a key lesson from Fukushima is we need to prepare for larger accidents. Historically, we've prepared just for accidents on par with Three Mile Island. That's a big concern for people living in the GTA with 10 reactors. And we've released this position statement with 40 other organizations that Ms. McClanahan will speak to in greater depth, about with suggestions on how to improve emergency response. I provided a copy to everyone on council. At a high level, this is about planning for larger accidents, protecting drinking water, protecting vulnerable communities. But it also gets to a point, I think, for your community, is all Ontarians deserve a similar level of public safety. And we have a particular concern in Windsor, Essex, because you don't have domestic reactors, that you've been given less attention than these other areas that have, frankly, where we've seen a lot of delays. And our recommendation to you would be to speak out. Last week, Ms. McClanahan and I spoke to Durham Regional Council. So this is the host community for 10 reactors, and made recommendations from this statement, and they passed some endorsements of that. And the council was also very worried about the limited consultation period, because they had also been waiting for this consultation. They passed a motion in favor of asking for an extension until the end of September, so their staff and citizens could look at this report more. And here I would like to flag a broader issue that I know is of concern to council. Is you'll see on screen some extracts from the report from their staff. Their staff specifically put in recommendations that whatever changes or upgrades happen to emergency response plans, like we want public safety to be strengthened, the cost should not be borne by the municipality. It's up to the province to figure out the how, but those costs should not be borne by the municipality. This goes on other files, whether it be flooding and whatnot, the province is responsible for public safety. But they were making that very clear in their recommendations to the province, and have said so publicly. Our organization's committed to echo those calls in our own submissions, and we'll be communicating that to other non-governmental organizations as well. And this, quickly, I think one of the examples of how your community has been not left behind but has got less attention, is the issue of KI distribution. Potassium iodine pills, frankly, came about partly because of our work. In our advocacy to the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission, it became very apparent to the commission that the province was dragging its feet. That KI distribution is a best practice in Europe. It should be used in Canada. And because the province was enacting, they imposed it on licensees. And what that meant, though, was that your community, because there's not a Canadian licensee, has been deprived of that. Moving forward, those requirements should be put into the provincial plan. It is ultimately the province's responsibility, and that's what we'll be advocating for. But the fact that it's 3 years later since Toronto got these pills, and you can order them free online, and your community hasn't had access yet, I don't think is acceptable. So there's, again, this gets back to the lack of urgency for your community. So in conclusion, I'll pass it off to Teresa. We think there's areas of cooperation, but we think there's a strength in speaking publicly to the government about your concerns, and you'll get more traction moving forward that way.
Thank you very much. My name is Teresa McClenahan. I'm Executive Director and Counsel with the Canadian Environmental Law Association. And we have been working on the topic of nuclear emergency planning for many, many years. And I've done detailed examination of the nuclear emergency plans around all of the Canadian plants, moving through various licensing hearings. In the document, the call for public safety that health organizations, nurses, environmental organizations have endorsed, we're saying to the province that the current provincial plan needs to be substantially upgraded to provide much better safety for citizens of Ontario in light of real-world accidents like Chernobyl and Fukushima. And in your case, you've got two American plants nearby, Fernie 2 and Davis Vesey. What we found out from Fukushima is that it's very necessary to much better plan for and protect vulnerable communities like seniors. Regulator from Japan told us at a 2013 hearing in Ottawa that we were delegates at, that it was the failure to take such big accidents seriously that led to some of the harm suffered by seniors when they were evacuated without medical care. They had never imagined they actually might have to do such a thing. So we want the province to require actual planning so that the seniors are identified, the children's facilities, the schools within the primary and secondary zones, incarcerated youth, and anyone else who's vulnerable. We also have been speaking for many years about the fact that there isn't any provision for protection of drinking water in the Nuclear Emergency Response Plan. In the 2013 letter that Sean Patrick was mentioning from the Minister of Community Safety to us, she indicated she would be asking Ontario officials to look at and develop contingency plans for drinking water in the case of a big nuclear accident, but that has not happened yet and it's not mentioned in this plan. Anywhere on the Great Lakes, all of the plants that are shown on the map could be an issue for drinking water for everyone downstream. And so we think that this is something that your municipality and other impacted municipalities should be echoing, that there really needs to be contingency planning if there was an accident, what in the real world would happen for people's drinking water. Transparency and public participation is something that Sean Patrick just mentioned. We think that right in the plan itself, it should specify not only that the plan would be regularly reviewed, which it does, but that it be regularly reviewed with public input, which would mean there'd be an opportunity to come back to you to look at what else is happening in your community, in the surrounding nuclear reactor communities, in terms of any experience in the broader global environment, and any necessary changes would be made at that time. There might be changes made in the plan now. I hope there will be as a result of this consultation, and then you'll have experience with that new provision and find out if it's working, and if not, you could give feedback the next time around to the province with public input. And we're also submitting that because Ontario, as well as the Great Lakes in general, have so many nuclear operating power plants, we feel that the citizens of Ontario, all of the citizens of Ontario, including your communities, deserve as good an emergency planning as anywhere in the world. Just last week in Switzerland, a decision was made to upgrade their nuclear plan to respond to Fukushima level accidents and to extend distribution of KI, among other things. We should have such strong emergency planning in Ontario. We shouldn't have measures that were in place before there even was a Chernobyl or a Fukushima experience elsewhere in the world. So in summary, we think that there's been a problem with Southwest Ontario being overlooked. The current plan that the province put out is not relying on any specific modeling, but we would say to you that you should ask the province to do that modeling, to require that modeling, in terms of what could happen from those American plants for your communities. In addition, the decision to double the primary zone is provided for other Ontario-based plants, but has not been provided for your community. We think that's unacceptable. And there's no discussion about how to prepare for an accident as a result of those plants. Rather, there's a statement that there will be further provisions included later, and we think this is the time to have an upfront discussion. So finally, we have made some recommendations for the sake of council to consider about the kinds of things we think you could constructively say to the province and ask the province to do, starting first and foremost with the communities who are in proximity to those US-based plants to be accorded the same level of public safety as communities living near the Bruce, Darlington, Pickering, and Chalk River plants in Ontario. We also think that there should be KI distribution and that residents right through the secondary zone should not have to pay to get KI pills, which are an important provision early in an accident sequence. And that the identification of vulnerable communities be explicitly required in the plan, that there be advertising to residents in the secondary zone that the KI pills are available, that, as I mentioned, there be transparent and regular public review, that drinking water is protected as a specific requirement within the plan, and that international best practices are met as well. So with that, we'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Just before I take questions, I'll go to the chief, I guess, for the town's position.
Thank you, Your Worship. In that I'm now your newly appointed CEMC, and the gentleman, along with the town clerk, who have really carried the lion's share of the work over the last 20 months to try and move this issue forward on your behalf. So I think I'm going to defer to the deputy, at least in the initial phases. In case he says anything, and then I can always.
Thank you, Your Worship. Sean Patrick, Teresa, thank you for being here. I've certainly, I welcome you. It's been an uphill battle the last 20 months since I've been here. I have to be careful what I say. I'll have the clerk looking at me because we're in negotiations with the province right now on a number of issues. One of the things I will say when we talk about the PNRB and the comments that are open, we will be submitting a number of comments to the province in regards to the PNRB, not only on the planning model, but a number of issues in the PNRB talk about the municipal responsibilities for Amherstburg that the other municipalities in Ontario don't have because the nuclear installations fund them, equip them, resource them. We get none of that here. KI pill distribution is mandated in Ontario with the exception of Amherstburg. Fortunately, we have a very proactive health unit who we've had the luxury of working with, and they have put a funding proposal together to the Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care for the KI pills, properly packaged in blister packs, requesting funding for public education and public messaging. And we're awaiting a response from them. They're saying maybe September they'll let us know. We're hopeful that that will occur. The challenge for us is where the municipalities in Ontario are concerned about their funding. I have a pretty good idea what their funding is, and it's certainly much more extravagant than the 25,000 Canadian that we get from Fermi. We get no funding from the province at all, or from any Canadian nuclear installation. So it's been a challenge for us. KI is one small portion of our challenge, funding, equipment. The municipalities in Ontario will have the luxury, if there is some type of nuclear incident, of having the expertise of the nuclear installations respond to their municipalities. We don't have that. So I welcome you bringing this attention to us, working with us in this. Modeling, that has been requested, apparently because it's not a can-do plant, and it's a different type of like boiled water reactor. They have to get that from Fermi. So that's a challenge. So we have a number of comments that we will be making in regards to the PNR and changes that we would like to see. We are definitely under-resourced down here in comparison to the municipalities who also have concerns. So we've been at this for probably 20 months now and have made some inroads. There are no funding mechanisms coming from the states. That's the reality. The challenge is going to be, where is it coming from in the province? We have submitted a resource needs list, and we're working towards that, and it continues. So I welcome your stop to Amherstburg, just to highlight the challenges we're facing and look for any support from a minister's level. And, like, you have certain doors open to you to meet with people, and I'm hoping that you can mention the concerns of the southwestern Ontario issues that you brought up.
Deputy Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Through you, to the fire chief, the deputy fire chief. I've been watching you for the last several months. Maybe you didn't feel my eyes behind you, but I was. And you guys are working hard, I know that. And we are moving forward. But again, I'd like to bring back, I've been here for a long time. I've been here for many, many years. And I remember when we first started our traffic routes and all that stuff. There was stuff there, but it got outdated and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't looked at that much in those days anyway. But I see the big change coming and I feel it, and it's great. Because when I look out and I see my friends and relatives out there, those really touch me in the heart. So sometimes I say things I shouldn't, but sometimes people deserve it. So thank you very much and keep up the good work. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I just want to add a couple other things. Just so you're aware, in discussions with the health unit, there was a student, emergency management student, doing their thesis. And recently, some surveys went out to the Amherst Point area, Boblo Island area, just to gauge the knowledge of what KI knowledge is in Amherstburg. I have a pretty good idea what it is, but we need it validated, and that's going to assist the health unit and the town in figuring out what our public education messaging is. And one other concern when we talk about the PNR, it talks about the uniqueness of the U.S. plant, and it's subject to agreement between Detroit Edison, Fermi, and the province of Ontario. There is no agreement. I've asked for it. There is no agreement. That's in the PNR. So that's another huge concern, that an agreement was never reached on that. And this is one of the challenges right now. If there was an agreement on funding, on response capabilities in the event of a nuclear incident, on equipment, on training, it certainly would be much better for the residents of our community.
And Mr. Mayor, in my opinion, it would be important to be expressing those kinds of views publicly on the record, in addition to your negotiation for the details that are required, much as Durham Region has done with the public statement that they want additional funding for the expanded responsibilities they will undertake. And absolutely, as the Deputy Chief is indicating, there are several responsibilities the municipality has according to the way the province assigns responsibility to the municipalities, such as managing evacuation zones, being prepared to evacuate people, helping with the notification, helping with reception centers, distributing the KI pills through the health unit, and all of those things are important responsibilities. Training, first responder training, is extremely crucial. So
it's extremely important to be continuing the negotiations, and I think because the province is consulting on the PNRC right now, it's also very important to make a public statement in collaboration with the other municipalities that it's a provincial responsibility to ensure that's resourced.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, following up on that, Durham Region also sensed the problem with transparency going back several years. They passed motions asking for the government to be more transparent on this dating back to 2013, because they also saw this as part of the problem set. And one of the things in the recommendations that Durham passed last week was that in the new PNRP there'd be requirements where the province would be required on certain timelines to allow municipalities to report back on the status of the PNRP on a regular basis. So that these types of problems, like the fact that there's no agreement with Fermi after 30 years, won't happen, or that there's an accountability mechanism. So I think that's why it's very important, again, to speak out and make these transparent. That's the only way that we've won advances over the past 6 years, even this consultation. It's a small start. But we need to make what is not what ought to be, and the changes, there should be changes made to the PNRP to address all the problems that the fire marshal has been faced with. It's unfair and unacceptable that it's dragged on this long, and we've been in that situation for the past 6 years. I'll give you the example from Switzerland, which announced last week they were gonna upgrade their planning basis. It's worked into their law that we're doing this, we will now consult with municipalities on those emergency measures. That's part of their law. We don't have that here on this issue, and we think that's one of the main problem sets. This council speaking out will motivate other councils to do the same, and we'll have a stronger voice to get traction with the province.
Thank you. Councilor Bougin?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. And I want to thank both of you, Sean Patrick and Teresa. You did an excellent presentation, and I concur with your concerns and our deputy chief and our deputy mayor's concerns. I just want to acknowledge two people that were very, very instrumental in our community, and I believe you had a chance to meet them just prior to the meeting. And I did speak to the mayor about both of these gentlemen, and it's Mr. Paul Purtle and Linwood Martin. And they were in the grassroots planning stages for nuclear emergencies at Firm Lake 2. And it dates back to 1987. They were both founding members of a community citizens group called ECCAF 2, and that was the Essex County Citizens Against Fermi 2. The group focused its energies on having an effective safety plan in place for the citizens of Amherstburg, Anderton, Malden, and surrounding communities of Harrow and LaSalle. And by 1993, they were successful in getting the province to see the merits of such a plan emerge. I've been on this emergency measures, and it changed names over the years, for the past 23 years. And I can tell you, at one time, the province was very, very involved. And they were so involved that they would come down and they would give us exercises. They would test us, they would train us. We were getting updates all the time, and since then, it's as if we don't exist anymore. So I do support everything you're doing, and I thank you for bringing this. Our deputy chief has been working on that for the past 20 months. We're very grateful for him. And I'm sure this council is prepared to move in the right direction.
Thank you. Other comments or questions? Okay, then I think I would defer to the clerk who has a motion prepared that should capture everything that we need.
If I may, for council's consideration, the motion was slightly redeveloped and tailored to suit Amherstburg this morning in conversation between administration, the mayor, Sela, and Greenpeace. The motion before council for consideration is that the government of Ontario ensure communities living in proximity of the Fermi and David Bessie nuclear stations be accorded the same level of funding, support, and public safety as communities living near the Ontario-based Bruce, Darlington, and Pickering nuclear stations. The government of Ontario include requirements in its updated provincial nuclear emergency response plan for the funding, public education, and pre-distribution and availability of potassium iodide pills for communities living in the proximity of the Fermi and Davis Bessie nuclear stations, equivalent to the requirements for Ontario-based nuclear stations. The determination of KI pre-distribution and availability of availability to communities living in proximity of the Fermi and Davis Bessie nuclear stations be informed by publicly available severe accident modeling and international best practices. The Government of Ontario require provincial authorities to regularly identify vulnerable communities within the provincial secondary zone and prepare emergency measures adapted to their needs. The Government of Ontario adopt a policy of requiring provincial authorities to inform residents, businesses, and institutions of the secondary zone, in the secondary zone, of the availability of potassium iodide pills at no cost to those residents, businesses, and institutions, and the desirability of including those pills in personal and institutional emergency kits. The Government of Ontario include new requirements within the PNR for transparency and regular public review, especially with affected municipalities. The Government of Ontario ensure adequate measures are in place to protect drinking water in the event that an accident at a Canadian or American-based reactor contaminates the Great Lakes, as well as contingency plans for incidents that may occur. The Government of Ontario adopt a policy of striving to meet international best practices in nuclear emergency response and planning measures wherever feasible. That administration be directed to share the 2016 amendment concerns discussed in the September 12, 2016 report to Council regarding the inequities identified in the PNR with respect to the town of Amherstburg through the PNR public consultation process, and that the corresponding Fermi 2 implementing plan also be amended to incorporate the requested funding and support by the town of Amherstburg to ensure a more robust nuclear emergency response for its community. And that the copy of this resolution be sent to municipalities of Essex, Amherstburg, Lakeshore, LaSalle, Leamington, Kingsville, Tecumseh, Peely, Windsor, and Chatham-Kent, WEC Health Unit, County of Essex, City of Toronto Office of Emergency Management, the Honorable Kathleen Wynne, Minister of Community Safety and Correctional Services, Minister of Health and Long-Term Care, the members of Provincial Parliament, Lisa Gretzky, Percy Hatfield, Taras
Manishak,
and Rick Nichols.
And move Councillor Pooja, I believe. Second Councillor Fryer. Is there any questions on that motion? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor? Carried. And I will thank our delegates for helping us out with this issue. We very much appreciate you taking your time to do that. Councillor Fryer?
I make a motion to receive both delegations.
Thank you. Second, Councillor Pouget. All those in favor? It's carried. That brings us to the next item, which is 10.1, Mr. Gordon Orr. And I do not see Lynette Bain.
No. No, Lynette Bain sent her regrets that I've got Christmas Eve. So, good evening, Your Worship, and members of Amherstburg Town Council. My name is Gordon Orr. I'm the CEO of Tourism Windsor Essex Peel Island. I'm joined tonight by Chris Racine, our Director of Marketing and Special Events. We're here tonight as part of a commitment that was made 5 years ago when we assumed the leadership roles of Tourism Windsor Essex Peely Island. We promised that we would attend the council meetings on a regular basis, not only at the city and the county council tables, but also at the local level, like we're here tonight. At each town council meeting, this is the third of 9 visits we are doing. We do this for a couple of reasons. First, we want to make sure our elected officials are better informed about the importance of tourism as a job creator and economic generator. And secondly, we want to provide you with an opportunity to ask any questions that you may have with us in this forum. We were last in these chambers about a year ago on May 9th, 2016, and it's good to be back. Tonight, we're here with the latest edition of our 2017-2018 visitor guide, just released in the middle of April, which we put at your tables there. And we have a brief PowerPoint presentation, which will be followed by the premiere of our regional video. So we'll start the PowerPoint now. First slide, please. Our vision mission, of course, a top-of-mind destination offering authentic and diverse experiences. Our mission is an industry collaborative committed to enhancing the region's economy and quality of life. Our core functions remain marketing communications, visitor services, event attraction, and product and program development. Slide, please. We have a board of directors, and there you can see is our organizational governance. We have 11 members on our board. We have a mix of politicians and stakeholders. You can see on our executive that Mayor Santos is the chair of our board from Kingsville, and county council is also represented by directors Warden Bain and Mayor Patterson from Leamington. Slide, please. We're guided by a five-year strategic plan, which operates under three strategic directions, which include growing the tourism industry and visitor experiences, maximizing key industry partnerships and relationships, and building our capacities to support the tourism industry. Chris, please.
When we look back at what we accomplished together within the United Visitor Industry, we put together a comprehensive document that was circulated to all members of council in early March. We want to highlight just a few of the more noteworthy accomplishments. On the award side, we won the 2016 Ontario Culinary Tourism Award, Best Ontario Culinary Tourism Experience for the Epic Wine Passport Program, accepted by TWEPI and Epic Wine Growers Association at the annual Ontario Tourism Summit. We were also a finalist in the Ontario Culinary Tourism Leadership Award, and we were the winner of the Motor City's National Heritage Areas Award for Excellence in Tourism for the launch of the Henry Ford Driving and Audio Tours. On the destination development side, we hosted four targeted workshops centered around topical and useful themes for our stakeholders: birding tourism, two-wheel tourism, TripAdvisor, and social media. Program launches, Barrels, Bottles, and Brews. It was a trail designed to celebrate the burgeoning craft brew industry combined with our distilleries, including craft whiskey, vodka, and our iconic brands, J.P. Weiser's and Canadian Club. We developed a regional tourism committee with town municipal staff charged with the tourism portfolio in their day-to-day work in an effort to enhance communications and harness synergies of working collectively. Waterfront Trail on Pelee Island, there you can see the Minister of Tourism, Culture and Sport with Gordon Orr at the launch of the Waterfront Trail on Pelee Island. Slide, please. In event development, we hosted four signature events, two in sport tourism, and two conventions that attributed significantly to our healthy hotel occupancies and higher than normal average daily rates. On the marketing side, 60 Days, 60 Reasons was a social media campaign that ran over the summer and featured day trip itineraries. Best of Windsor Essex campaign, it was a social media campaign designed to have locals tell us where visitors would like to go. And Windsor Essex Staycation Giveaway Expo was a partnership with Devonshire Mall to host a tourism megaplex of 30 exhibitors promoting to 20,000 daily mall visitors. Social media contests also ran to support the idea of staying closer to home. Social media marketing, you can see there was some tremendous growth in all our social media platforms and for our website as well.
Thanks, Chris. Under the Canada 150 celebrations, we designed a logo, and much like the Canada 150 logo, we wanted to create a logo, and rather than develop a new one, we modified ours to match the branding of Canada 150. Slide, please. We wanted to create a regional hub, which we did, called we150.ca, that promoted tourism-related activities as they relate to Canada 150. This hub is searchable by event and or by community, and we also created the hashtag we150 to encourage folks to share what they experienced. Slide, please. In reference to our marketing and destination development strategies, our areas of focus for 2017 are under arts and culture, cultural districts and arts initiatives, under outdoor adventure, two-wheeled adventures and our waterfront, under food and drink, our culinary and wine and bottles and brews, and under entertainment, gaming, events and shopping. Slide, please. Our Plenty of Reasons campaign continues, recognizing that we are blessed with numerous tourism assets with no one iconic attraction. And we decided to highlight plenty of reasons to visit and plenty of reasons why you love this place.
Next slide, please. To capitalize on the continuation of the strong US dollar and to capture more of the US leisure market, we will launch, with the help of our tourism partners and the Ontario Tourism Marketing Partnership, a campaign centered around our Plenty of Reasons to Visit creative in Q3 and Q4 of this year. You can see on the screen the list of funding partners so far who have contributed to this $100,000 campaign. We applied for and were successful in being awarded $30,000 from the OTMPC through their Tourism Industry Partnership Program Fund, for which we are very grateful. Next slide, please. Some stakeholder initiatives, partner portal, in an effort to build upon our capacities to support our stakeholders in a secure, convenient, efficient, and effective way, we created a partner portal. The portal was tested during the solicitation of sales for the visitor guide that started this past January. Feedback so far has been positive. The portal is being used for updating stakeholder information, uploading photos, and submitting events to the calendar, download of industry reports, and partnership opportunities. Launched last week is our all-new coffee trail, promoting locally owned businesses in Windsor, Essex, who serve quality artisanal coffee and is the first of its kind in Ontario. We created a landing page on our existing website exclusive to members of the trail, demonstrating what makes their location and coffee unique. Next slide, please. Year-over-year key performance indicators for 2016 for 2017, more Americans came by car, 4% increase, and more people flew into YQG, over 40% growth. Our hotel figures are very encouraging and seeing some positive growth. And our, slide please, marketing efforts has driven traffic to our website and grown some of our social media channels.
Slide please. For the first quarter of 2016 over 2017, year-over-year growth of 1.5% in hotel occupancy with close to a $5 increase in the average daily room rate. Slide please. And there you can see our Q1 stats for 2016 versus 2017. Some very positive figures again on our social media platforms. Slide please. There before you is our 2016-2017 visitor guide. Grew to 88 pages from 84 pages this year based on demand. We print 95,000 copies of these booklets and we distribute them throughout Ontario, Michigan, and Ohio. Slide please. One of the reasons why we're here tonight is because June is tourism month. We have a number of activations planned to promote the importance of this industry to our region and celebrate all of the good work that is happening within the United Visitor Industry. Slide please. Last week, we held and we hosted our annual general meeting on June 8th at the Capitol Theater and had some heavy hitters as speakers relevant to the tourism industry. There you can see Beth Potter as the President and CEO of the Tourism Industry Association of Ontario, also known as TILE, and the Honorable Eleanor McMahon, Minister of Tourism, Culture and Sport. They joined 120 plus people in attendance, including some in this very room. Slide, please. There, any golfers out there, our fall networking event is the sixth annual tournament on Monday, September the 18th at Kingsville Golf and Country Club, and we ask that you save the date, and details will be released within the next couple of weeks. And then slide, please. Thank you very much for your time this evening, and more importantly, for supporting and continuing to invest in tourism and your support of tourism in Windsor-Essex Peel Island. I'd be remiss, Your Worship, if I didn't thank. We have the pleasure of dealing with a number of your administration on a daily basis. Certainly, you're at the front and center of that is your titans of tourism over there, from Amherstburg, Ann Rhoda, Jennifer Ibrahim, fantastic. Also from your recreation division, Rick Daly is very, very cooperative and helpful. And I also have called upon your CAO for some very important events that we've had, and he's always been there, and we thank him for his participation and active leadership as well. So we'd like to conclude by showing the video, and then we'd be welcome to answer any questions.
hungry and thirsty.
I was just thinking the same thing. Questions? Okay, Councilor Melosh?
Thank you for the presentation. The question I have, do you break down in terms of the dollars coming in between what happens in the city, you know, say more the city versus the county? I mean, the casino has to have a big influence on attracting, you know, what we refer to as tourists or other, from other countries. Do you have that breakdown in terms of looking at what I'm going to call the effectiveness of the dollars spent and then getting out into the county?
Sure. Thank you for the question through your worship to the councilor. Very, very difficult. As a matter of fact, we used to have information that drilled down to Windsor Essex as a region. And now they're combining it through the Statistics Canada and through the Ministry of Tourism into what they call RTOs. A number of years ago, they broke this into regional tourism organizations, and there's 9 or 10 of them across the province. So now they're breaking it down into those figures. What I can tell you is the latest stats we've heard from the regional tourism organization side of it is that they receive 7.8 million visitors who leave behind $1.7 billion, with 33% of that spend coming right here from our own backyard. So a little over $500 million of economic activity. We've never really drilled it down between city and county. We consider ourselves a regional entity. Sometimes we might swing a little more to doing stuff in the city and then other times in the county. We've recognized that the product development, a lot of our initiatives are really geared towards the county and some of the more larger sporting events and some of the conventions that happen because of the hotel infrastructure. We'd be more than reliant on the city. But we feel we do a pretty good balance of trying to make sure that all of our stakeholders are represented and at the same time not favoring one over the other. But certainly the economic benefit is significant. And tourism is, as I mentioned, an economic generator and a job creator, and over 16,000 people are employed in this industry throughout the region. So I don't know if that specifically answered your question, but okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Councilor Pryor?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Thank you for your presentation, as always. And I'm much appreciative to you giving accolades to Jennifer and Ann and Rick. The question I got, and many people have asked me before, is Amherstburg the top for festivals in the county and Windsor? For weeks after weeks, you look at how many events Ann has brought to Amherstburg and how many have come after Shrewsbury and the success from that year after year being a top 100 festival in Ontario. So I'm just curious, you know, residents see the inconvenience sometimes of weekends being taken up by tourism or tourists being here in our area. Is Amherstburg the top of the heap when it comes to the weekend after weekend of festivals for one municipality?
Well, through your worship to the councillor, thank you for the question, and certainly this is being recorded, so I would say that we're lucky to enjoy across this great region of ours multiple festivals and events happening every weekend from May through October. What I will say is any time that there's been something in the town of Amherstburg, you guys can continually hit it out of the park without questions because of the leadership of those two seated there who we've mentioned, the support of council, obviously, and the leadership you've taken. We certainly very much appreciate the investment that the town of Amherstburg makes in all of the delivery of services from a tourism standpoint. So I'm not going to say that you're the top of the heap, maybe after dinner.
That was a great political answer.
Well, thank you very much. Very good. I've learned a few things.
Is there any other questions? Okay, I will say that it's been my experience that you have supported many events in the town of Amherstburg, and we do very much appreciate that. Thank you very much. Motion to receive, Councilor Melosh and Councilor Courtney. All those in favor? Carried. That brings us to 10.2, the Healthy Kids Community Challenge. Rick Daly and Joe Perrin.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, and good evening, Council. We just heard from Gordon Crescent, and they talked about all the wonderful beverages, wine and whiskey and beer, and we get to talk about water. I'm here with Joel Parent. He is the project manager for Healthy Kids Community Challenge for Windsor Essex. And we're here to provide an update on what has transpired in the project to date as well as going forward. But before we do that, I want to talk about how we got here and some of the stats that surround why we're here talking about this project. Almost one in every three children in Ontario has an unhealthy weight. Obesity is threatening the sustainability of our healthcare system. Windsor Essex residents report higher rates of obesity, other chronic diseases, and negative lifestyle patterns than the rest of the province. And in a previous report that came to council regarding June as Parks and Rec Month, there were some staggering stats in there as well. Stats Canada demographics from 2014, there's 40.2% of all Ontarians consider themselves to be overweight or obese. And according to the Childhood Obesity Foundation, childhood overweight and obesity has been steadily rising in Canada. Between 1978 and 2004, overweight and obese children have grown between the ages of 2 and 17 years of age from 15% to 26%. That means if the trends continue, by 2040, up to 70% of adults over the age of 40 will either be overweight or obese. With that being said, the health unit brought together municipal, educational, and health stakeholders to discuss a funding opportunity through the Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care, and that was a Healthy Kids Community Challenge. From this initial meeting, the stakeholders agreed that rather than an individual application from each municipality, the region would submit one application with a greater reach and scope. In March of 2014, Town Council approved a motion that supported the joint application between Windsor Essex County stakeholders to the Healthy Community Kids Challenge, focusing on combating obesity in children ages 12 and under. Now, to fast forward to today, I'd like to introduce Joel Parent, who's going to provide some background of the project itself and some of the successes and challenges.
Okay, thank you, Rick, Mayor, members of council, for giving us the opportunity to come here and present the Healthy Kids Community Challenge and what we have been doing in Windsor, Essex. The project originated, as Rick said, through the Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care through their No Time to Wait report of 2013, which really recommended a community-based program to increase the health and wellness of children 0 to 12 years old. It's based on the EPOD methodology, which is basically a childhood obesity best practice that is recognized by the World Health Organization, which really identifies the need to, we were delivering, partnering with the health unit in their Take Charge program. Our message locally was Take Charge, Choose Water. And that's what we have been delivering, and you'll see a nice pull-up banner in the entrance of the building here stating that. So again, some of the activities under theme two, we installed 6 new water bottle filling stations in Windsor, Essex. That's again with that supportive environment piece to increase public access to water. There was one installed at the Libro Center along with some signage and some poster holders that will also be, they haven't yet, but they will also be installed at the location to promote water. We also distributed a number of reusable water bottles, and I actually have some here tonight that I'll hand out after the presentation. Just really to encourage reusable water and reusable tap water, and not the use of one-use disposable water bottles.
Some of the activity under this theme, like Joe had mentioned, we did have a water bottle refill station installed at the Libro, and as of March, 2017, it's been used to an equivalent of almost 3,500 water bottles since it was first installed. And what that means is that there's an indicator on the machine that identifies how many water bottles would have been filled if we had used bottled water. So it really helps with the environment perspective as well. Again, we also had free activities for youth and families, and at those activities, we provided 400 water bottles free of charge, as well as we also introduced fruit-infused water at all our summer camps as well. So it gets away from bottled water and gets them away from sugar-infused drinks as well.
Theme two, again, with the schools, what we did there, they participated in IRCA's annual Water Fest. They also received a booklet, an activity booklet, on what they could do to increase your water intake, and those were, again, delivered to all the schools in the area. There was also training done at the Amherstburg OEYC centers on Water Does Wonders. A toolkit was provided to those Ontario Earlier centers, along with a sugar shocker kit to really inform those families with young children on how much sugar is included in a lot of sugary drinks and juices and things. Also, some child-sized pictures were given to those Earlier centers, along with storybooks promoting water consumption. So now we're on to theme three. We are currently in the midst of theme three, which is choose to boost veggies and fruit. It's the promotion of fruit and vegetable consumption. Basically, those underlying themes for this, underlying messages within this theme are consuming vegetables and fruit with every meal and snack, consume a variety of fruit and vegetables, eat the whole fruit and skip the juice, choose local, seasonal for affordability, and involve children in the preparation. There's a lot of good reasons to promote the consumption of fruit and vegetables, but I understand we have a limited time. So again, to really reduce childhood obesity and also to really chronic disease is an important component that we're trying to reduce. We have a lot of community partners throughout Windsor and Essex County that are helping us to deliver this program. It is not a huge chunk of funding, so we really rely on the partnerships to be able to help us to deliver these messages. Please go to our website for more information on the project, and I'll take any questions.
Okay, Councilor Kuja.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Through you to Rick and Joe, thank you so much for this presentation. It really appears that you've both done a lot of work, and we really appreciate it. I just have one question. It appears that all the schools were covered in Amherstburg except for one, Malden Public. Was there a reason, or did they just not want to take part in it?
The schools were chosen based on their location within those dissemination zones. So if they were within one of those dissemination zones, they were part of our outreach. Even if they were next to one of those dissemination zones and the majority of their population came from those areas, we included them. However, if their population and the building itself wasn't located, they were not included. Thank you.
And just to add to that, that's one of the reasons why, as a rec department, we chose not to do that with our programming, and we encompassed everybody, so including residents of Malden Center as well.
Councilor Walsh.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I agree with the program, which you guys got going. It's important for the younger children to begin to eat healthy. The issue where I'm going, though, is that education is a big part, but education, probably 75% of the education has to go towards the parent, not the child. And I guess, how are you guys, or your organization, sort of addressing that issue in terms of convincing the parent that that's healthy for their child to eat?
Yeah, thank you for the question. You're absolutely right that addressing the parents is important. We're doing that through the Ontario Earlier Centers, and addressing the whole family, the children at the centers, but primarily the moms and dads that bring their children there. A lot of the information that is sent home to the schools is actually information that's sent home with the children, and it's aimed at targeting their parents. This round, we're doing some cooking, meal preparation types of events, and those are for the whole family, so it's not just the children, it's for parents and children to engage in those as well.
And that's fine. I guess there's, you still need some kind of a mechanism, what I call, for follow-up, because many times you get this brought from school, a bunch of paperwork, and it gets put on the table somewhere and lost forever. And I guess, how does your organization somehow, have a coupon or something that says, hey, take it here or bring it here, do this. Some feedback is, I guess, valuable to your organization from what I can see here.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing, again, we're addressing that through the parents. A lot of change, however, takes place when school children, especially elementary school children, really advocate to their parents. So as we are delivering messages within school system, I would hazard to guess that a lot of recycling is really, you know, was really established by kids, you know, getting home and saying, we need to recycle more, we need to recycle more. So we are delivering messages to the parents, but also that constant message from the kids up to their parents, I think is also one way to increase that follow-up. That it's not, they're not, the follow-up isn't necessarily coming from us, the follow-up is coming from their children that are promoting, let's eat more vegetables and fruit, because that's what I'm seeing at the recreation center, that's what I'm seeing at school, that's what I'm seeing at the doctor's office. We need to be eating more fruits and vegetables. So that's kind of the approach we're using as well.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions or comments? Okay, seeing none, a motion to receive. Councilor Melosh, second deputy mayor. All those in favor? Carried, and thank you, gentlemen, for your presentation.
Thank you. Could I just have a second to hand out these water bottles?
Sure.
All right. You're welcome.
Actually, we have quite a bit left, so I think I'll call a 10-minute break right now.
I think you got one of those earlier ones, so I got you a different one.
Recess there, Councilor Levine and Councilor Melosh, all those in favor? Thank you.
We're all going there.
Oh, you're ready? Okay, motion to resume. Councilor Levine, Councilor Melosh, all those in favor? Carried. And motion to adjourn. Councilor Fryer, Deputy Mayor, all those in favor? Carried. Thank you, everyone.
So I said to the recruiter, John.